It is my pleasure once again, and perhaps finally, to welcome Jim Wilson, our own Jim Wilson, the store manager at Many Rivers. I was just a moment ago reflecting on how long I've been hearing Jim do talks, public talks, and it's got to be more than a quarter century at this point, for sure. Getting on towards 30 years. So what I want to say is all good things must come to an end eventually. He has promised that this will be his last public talk. Now, who knows what we can persuade him to do in the future? You know, arms are twistable, but this is what he has promised himself. And Jim has been a Dharma teacher. Someone just came in today and happened to mention what a wonderful teacher he's heard Jim has been. And you'll get the chance to experience that for yourselves tonight. His clarity shows in his writing as well as in his public speaking. And it's my delight to welcome again Jim Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming out on this beautiful July evening. I'd like to begin with a simple contemplation. It's a simple chant. We'll be chanting the syllable ah. So taking in a deep breath, on the exhale, the syllable ah. Pick a relaxed pitch, not real low, not real high, something that's very easy. And you don't have to chant loudly, just in a very relaxed, natural way. And we'll just do that for several minutes. And when I hit the bell, then you can end the chanting. you. Tonight, what I'd like to do is I'm going to be talking about silence. So many people have remarked about there's a paradox in talking about silence, but that we can work with that paradox. So what I'm going to do is just touch on what I would call facets of silence, various ways of looking at silence, various ways that different spiritual traditions have treated silence, and I'd like this to be an open discussion. So if people have any comments or observations or questions they want to raise while I'm yammering away, please feel free to enter into the discussion. There's one aspect of silence which I'd like to start off with and kind of bracket it and put it aside, and I call that silence as oppression. So there is the oppressed are silenced, and often very, very strongly, so it's important to acknowledge that, that's an aspect of silence that we're not, particularly striving to achieve, the silence we enter into as part of a spiritual practice or tradition, in some ways, kind of resembles that. And I know Sarah Maitland. This is her book called A Book of Silence. It hasn't been published in the United States yet, but a friend of mine sent this to me. It should be out later this year. She was very involved in politics, and then she became a devout Episcopalian, and she was pursuing what I would call hermit practices, and part of it was silence. And she received letters from some of her political friends that says, well, here we've been trying to give a voice to the voiceless and now you're pursuing exactly what we've been trying to, not have, for certain people. So she worked with that a while, and it's one of the things I appreciate about this book is how she opens up, pointing that out. The difference between silence as a spiritual practice and silence as oppression is coercion. Silence as oppression happens when one person coerces another, or a group coerces another, that is, physically intimidates them. And whether or not something is undertaken voluntarily or under constraint makes all the difference in the world. Any questions or comments about that? Does that make sense?
Are you saying silence used as a weapon?
Silence can be a weapon.
I'm reminded of things like the West Point silent treatment and in certain ashrams and spiritual schools, if you leave or you're thrown out, all the devotees are not allowed to speak to you anymore. It becomes like it's actual torture. If you speak a little more on that, why would this be carried out? Why do we react to when a group ceases to communicate to you? Why has this become agonizing?
Well, if you think of little children, if the significant adults in their life ignore them, they become extremely agitated about that. They might pull on your sleeve, or after a while they might yell. or do something in order to be paid attention. So if you've been involved in a community and you're deeply embedded in that community, and then the community ejects you, it's a similar kind of relationship that you have. It's like everyone who used to pay attention to you is no longer paying attention to you, and that can be a strong psychological shock. So, like I said, I'd like to acknowledge that, but I don't want to dwell on that. That's not, the main focus. Many of you know that I have a long background in Zen and Buddhist practice. And there, people seek the silence. They go off to the silence. They run to the silence. So that's kind of what I'm want to explore. At first it seems like silence is pretty easy to understand. The first impulse that people have about silence is the absence of sound. But the more you contemplate silence, the more difficult it is to sort of get a feeling for exactly what it is, because there's no place you can go where there's no sound. A good working definition, which I'm going to modify later in the talk, but it's a good starting point, is silence is the absence of human speech rather than the absence of sound. It is particularly the absence of human speech. And at first, that seems to be giving up something that makes us distinctively human. In general, human beings believe that speech is uniquely human. There's a lot of arguments against that, but it's a widely held view. That human beings are uniquely speech embodied, and the human beings spend a great deal of time and energy talking, writing, reading, engaged in speech acts of various kinds. So to deliberately give up talking and speech seems to be bracketing something which makes us distinctively human. It also seems to be bracketing what I would call culture. Human culture is primarily embodied in speech and symbolic speech, books, literature, those kinds of things. The reason I say that is, even though you have, say, buildings and things of that nature, what those buildings mean is mediated by speech. So, when an archaeologist discovers a building sometimes, or a human site, sometimes it's difficult to know what the usage was, because we can't ask someone, what did you use this for? And they can't explain to us through speech what was going on there. So giving up, entering into silence is bracketing all that. Why would we do that? why would human beings want to deliberately bracket all of that?
I had a question, Jim. Yeah. You were including reading and writing as part of the absence of human speech.
Yes. There are gray areas about that. When you read the literature about hermits, most hermits do a lot of reading, but not all hermits. In the early Christian hermits, most of them, and I'm talking about 200, 300, that period, most of them couldn't read. So when they went off into the desert, what they did was memorize passages, usually the Psalms. So when you read about, say, the desert fathers and the desert mothers, contemplating the Psalms, what it meant was that they had memorized them. Not that they had the book there. In the real early centuries of Christianity, there was no text. I didn't even really understand that until very recently. You know, and, I'm trying to remember who was the founder of Christian Hermits. I'm trying to Athanasius. Can't remember his name, but I went back and read a short biography of him, and he was not unable to read, but he had memorized the Book of Psalms, and so he could contemplate them whenever he needed to.
Nguyenka makes the distinction between silence and noble silence.
Yes.
And he says that it means not just not talking, but it means also not making eye contact,
right,
or keeping your focus inward,
right,
which is much more powerful kind of silence.
Right. In a lot of monastic traditions, including Christian monasticism and Buddhist monasticism, it is extended to what courts call speech acts. So that you would not, look at somebody eye to eye. And
or a gesture.
Or a gesture, that sort of thing. And Thomas Merton has some funny stories to tell about how Trappist monks would communicate with each other with, these hand gestures. And sometimes they would get called on the carpet, for that kind of thing.
So that kind of implies that it's the communication that is being silenced. Whereas when you first asked the question, I was thinking it's more if you don't have talking and words and all, that you would receive a different kind of impression from the outside.
Right.
Or, it would be a different world if we could just see it as it is instead of always having all these words in between.
Thank you for mentioning that, because that's been my observation. When entering into silence, there is the possibility of a person experiencing the larger context in which they dwell. So human beings, I call this silence as nature. So human beings are very naturally caught up in their own situation. So there's nothing particularly wrong with that, or it's not like a evil plot against humanity by some crazed deity. We tend to be focused all day long on our situation in the sense of, I have to shop for food, and then I have to do this errand, and then I have to do that, and then I have to do that, and don't forget about that, and 3 weeks from now I was supposed to do that, but I can't, so I better call, and that kind of thing. And what happens is that becomes habitual, and our universe shrinks too, and we begin to think that the human world is the only world. I mean, it's not even that we think that, it's that it becomes sort of the frame of mind that we live in. And we forget that the human world is embedded in this in a cosmos. You could sort of say there's the human world and there's the cosmos. And there's also the world of transcendence. In a lot of the hermit literature, when they talk about silence, they talk about it in terms of renunciation, so that you can begin to intuit the presence of the divine, which is very quiet. It doesn't put up a neon sign. It doesn't advertise. And so it's necessary for us to become quiet so that the presence of the divine can begin to be sensed or felt or intuited or depending on the tradition, that's worded in different ways. But over and over again, I found in the literature of people who've undertaken extended silence is a sense of peace and ecstasy or bliss as the sense of that larger context becomes more and more real, more and more felt. I think that's the primary reason that someone would bracket verbalization, like it would be, you know, it would be considered worth the effort to do that.
Jim, I'm not quite sure bracketing is something that I relate to in my thought, but taken the experience of choosing not to talk, not involving oneself in writing, and various aspects related to the mind, then silence can be silence in its wholeness of quieting the total mind process.
Mm-hmm.
And if that can happen, or those momentary instances of that happening, then is that fullness of eternal presence.
Mm-hmm.
Is more, I start to say able to be experienced, but that's not necessarily so. It's just there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's beautiful. Yes, Michael?
I feel like we cannot give too much emphasis to the quality of presence, and associating the quality of presence with the name of silence, and to disassociate the word absence of sound or absence of anything, because silence is that quality of presence which has always been here, will always be here. And so what I'm wondering is if the sound is calling attention to the quality of presence, is it breaking the silence?
Thank you for bringing that up. That I'm going to address that question toward the end of my talk when I contrast what I call Buddhist and Quaker silence. Because I think that's one of the things which distinguishes the two. On the first point that you touched, silence is absence and silence is presence. That's the framework around which this book is written. She first experienced silence as an absence, that is, the absence of me speaking, the absence of people chattering with me, not turning on her TV, not turning on her radio, one of the interesting things about viewing silence is that way is that when you view silence that way, it's always kind of stressful. It's like you're pushing against your desires, to engage in speech, to find out what your favorite website has posted, there's always kind of temptations. But if you view silence as a presence, then you cross a certain barrier, But it's really hard to define exactly what that presence is, different traditions define it in different ways. It is the presence of God, it's the presence of the divine, it is the presence of the light within, it is Buddha nature. Different traditions would address that variously, when you begin to feel that presence, then it becomes much easier. It's not like you're in a, it's not like you're, it's not, there's not friction about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have an early experience of silence when I was first studying Zen. I was fresh from a philosophy degree, and you know, like when you're younger than me, which just about everybody is, and you have a philosophy degree, it's like, you know, you have things sort of figured out. And like, so there I was at the Zen Center, and we would have our weekly house meeting, and I would have something to say about every single issue. I mean, I'd been there, like, you know, like, I was the newest person there. You know, like. So my teacher goes, "Your mouth will get you in big trouble." And so he asked me to go on silence. Actually, he didn't ask me. He put me on silence. So I was really startled, but I also was up to the challenge, you know. Yeah. And so I was silent. So the next house meeting came around, and people had, you know, situation came up. The one that I remember was how best to share the laundry machine. You know, and of course I had, you know, the solution. But I had was, you know, vowed to silence, so, you know, I'm going. And people thought of a solution that I hadn't even thought of. And it was really good. It was really good, much better than mine. You know? How embarrassing. So I went for 17 days. You know, like, and then I had an interview with my teacher, and he said it's okay now. He said, you know, like, you can, you know, I told him about the experience with the laundry kind of thing, and he goes, good, you know, like, that's good. So I call that I call that silence is therapy. It's kind of therapeutic silence, mm-hmm. You know, like, and what that kind of silence does is that it shows you the habit impulses of your own mind. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it shows, you know, like, because you have decided to constrict yourself, you know, like, and put a barrier to speech, then the impulse to speak shows up, and you begin to see what it is that you're doing. It's a very good antidote to gossip, rumor mongering, you know, like, those kinds of things, or arrogance. If you're, you know, you have to be willing, you can still evade it. I mean, you can still, but it does give an opportunity to see the habit pattern on the screen of your own mind, because you put up, a break on that. You know, it's like the impulse arises, instead of just going with it, you know, you begin to see it, you know, like. And I think that's why in some spiritual traditions, I think that's why they do it. You know, like, I think particularly for newcomers. You know, I mean, I was a newcomer at the Zen Center. You know, it's sort of like before you can get into the life of the community and the spiritual practice, you need to see your own impulses and how they might be destructive to that communal life. How they might not be, you know, like, conducive to that spiritual life. How they might be going in a different direction. I think it's a wonderful tool for breaking certain kinds of habit forces. Jack Kornfield told a story about, this was many, many years ago when he was at Barry in Massachusetts, how he adopted the practice of not speaking about anyone who is not physically present. Like, which is sort of it's a modified silence. You know, like, I like this because you can think of degrees of silence instead of, you know, like, either or. You know, like, and what that helped him do was cut through the tendency to gossip. You know, like, he simply would not talk about somebody who is not physically present, right? And what you get to do is you get to see the impulse to talk about someone who's not present, and you get to see that the reason you want to talk about someone who's not physically present is because you have something nasty to say about them. Or, you know, like not particularly flattering, or you get to tell a story which flatters you in relationship to them, or, you know, like that kind of thing. You know, like, so this kind of practice can be embarrassing. I mean, I was embarrassed at the Zen Center when I realized how compulsive my tendency was to offer suggestions which really had no merit. but it's good. It's good to see that. You know, like, but you have to have a certain amount of strength. It's good if you have a, you know, like some kind of teacher or counselor or spiritual guide in this kind of context. Yeah.
What if you are saying something positive about somebody else and they're not?
Well, it's good to, you know, then a little gold star. Yeah. But if you're, you know, if you're engaging in that kind of practice, you would let that go too. I mean, you wouldn't say that. You know, like, so you might say, for a week, I'm not going to speak about anyone unless they're physically present. And then observe what happens. You can even do it for a weekend. You know, like, it's hard to do it. I have done it in the world, you know, like, but it's hard to do it, say, at work. You know, like, if your boss says, what do you think of, you know, so-and-so? And then you say to your boss, well, I'm sorry, I can't talk about someone unless you bring them here. Yeah, like, that would be hard. But it is possible, say, to do it on a weekend or like, on a day off or something like that. Or even half a day, you know, like that's even half a day is enough to sort of get a feel for what that does.
The denial of silence. It reminded me of when I was living in Brooklyn. Friends of mine were Jewish that were associated with the Hasidic Jews, as well as with the
right.
And I went to one of their, where they studied, and there'd be a room full of them, you know, the, I don't know what the titles would be, but they were on benches and tables, and they would sit, and it was the opposite of what you're saying. Spiritually, there'd be maybe, I don't know, maybe 60 guys in there, and they were all talking at once when you get started, one here and there, and they're all talking. And they crosstalk. One, you know, you train the ear where you hear two benches over. No, Simon, that's wrong. But the silence was that there was three levels of. The first was the talking about yourself, and that was silenced. There was no talking yourself. And the second was no talking about life things, like did the Yankees win that day?
Yeah.
What the news items were, and yet that third level, which was about, you know, the first five books of Moses and scripture and questions related. You could have like questioning things, but what I got from my friend was telling me that it wasn't that easy to do, because once you would hear like others talk, and you would want to, you could alter your scripture talk to what you heard. Your mind did. But you had to stay there. You couldn't use I or mine or anything like that, or personal opinions about what you sort of had to do. And it was very strict and tense. But I remember at the time I wasn't well prepared for things like that, and my overall impression was it was extremely boring. but now I look back and it seems like probably a really good use of silence, you know, inside you're controlling yourself. The only time in my life where I experience that is where I'm dealing with someone where I like to call them a goddamn asshole, you know, you're stupid, but I gotta stay silent. And stay, especially like with my boss or something, you know, and be cordial, and I don't feel And my question would be, does silence produce a false sense of ourselves, you know, like we're not really expressing, you know, where you feel like you want to say something that's really you, but there's a withhold in you saying I'm afraid, or it's not the right thing to do, or cause me harm?
That would be a type of silence. I would put that as almost like internal oppression, you know, like or internal suppression, you know, like. And the description you have about the Jewish gathering, that's the way Talmud is studied, you know, like you keep it on that level, you know, Rabbi so and so said this, Rabbi so and so said that, you know, like, and that's a very ancient tradition for textual exegesis. You know, like, and it's very, if you're immersed in that, it's very thrilling.
Yes.
You know, like, it's very exciting. You know, like, but in that case, the silence is used as a tool to keep your focus. You know, like, to keep your focus and to not stray from the realm of the holy.
Does the Buddhism, the silence that's practiced, is that preparation for being able to talk in a group where it's a higher level?
No, I haven't seen that. I mean,
so it's just meditation.
It's just meditation, yeah.
Just a little thought on that. In Tibetan Buddhism, the first time I went, I was very surprised because the actual goings-on was absolute cacophony.
But
it was beautiful because it was possible and actually really full and wonderful. It was to discover silence in the midst of that, to find that degree of relaxation and settling down.
Thank you.
In the midst of that.
Yeah. There is a close equivalent to the Talmudic debates in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, like where they argue in a very systematic way on the discussions on the dialectic of emptiness, you know, like Chandrakirti said, you know, like Nagarjuna said, you know, like, you know, Gelug so-and-so said, you know, like, and they... I'm clapping my hands because that's what they do. They, you know, they mean I scored. You know, you're the loser. You know, like it's right.
You're in.
Yeah, you're tagged. You're it. You know, like and also, you know, it's very active. You know, they're not sitting down. They're, you know, like walking around and very much engaged. Yeah.
And during the actual practices, separate from the debating, you can have drums, you can have cymbals, you can have different types of trumpets, bells, all these different things that come in and out of the chanting at different times.
How do you like that Tibetan chanting? It's good to be reminded that silence is not a universal spiritual practice. Not every tradition. You know, like, the largest Buddhist traditions in the world do not practice silence. They practice chanting. You know, like, in East Asia, the largest Buddhist tradition is Pure Land Buddhism. And they don't practice silence. They chant. You know, like, it's good to be reminded of that. You know, like, but I want to return to silence here and just sort of, yeah, it is... beautiful to me to observe how silence as a practice crops up in different spiritual traditions. You know, like it seems to be a human need, you know, at a certain level. there's another approach to silence which I call silence as prayer. Thank you. And in the Christian tradition, this is known as apophatic silence, so meaning apophatic, without speaking. Apophatic means without speaking. You know, like, and it is a manifestation of, it is the primary practice of Christian mysticism. It is a very rich vein of spirituality, the cloud of unknowing. Are people familiar with that? Mm-hmm. The cloud of unknowing is a very important work on the practice of apophatic prayer, but it is put in the context of prayer. In the mystical Christian tradition, this kind of silence is considered to be like there's kind of a ladder of prayer, you know, like, and so at the lower rungs you're making a lot of requests and petitions, you know, like, you know, give me this, give me that, you know, like, do this for me, do that for me, you know, like, and you sort of ascend the practice of prayer into this final state of silence, which is a communion with the divine, with God. And the root text of this approach is called Mystical Theology by my man Dionysus the Areopagite, you know, like one of my favorite works of all time. And just to give you a taste, Mystical Theology is in five very brief sections. The whole work is maybe 6 or 7 pages long. And I will just read you the last section, which is called Chapter 5. That the supreme cause of every conceptual thing is not itself conceptual. Again, as we climb higher, we say this: it is not soul or mind, nor does it possess imagination, conviction, speech, or understanding, nor is it speech per se, understanding per se. It cannot be spoken of, it cannot be grasped by understanding. It is not number or order, greatness or smallness, equality or inequality, similarity or dissimilarity. It is not immovable, moving, or at rest. It has no power. It is not power. It is not light. It does not live, nor is it life. It is not a substance, nor is it eternity or time. It cannot be grasped by the understanding, since it is neither knowledge nor truth. It is not kingship. It is not wisdom. It is neither one nor oneness, divinity nor goodness. Nor is it a spirit in the sense that we understand that term. It is not sonship or fatherhood, and it is nothing known to us or to any other being. It falls neither within the predicate of non-being nor of being. Existing beings do not know it as it actually is, and it does not know them as they are. There is no speaking of it, nor name, nor knowledge of it. Darkness and light, error and truth, it is none of these. It is beyond assertion and denial. We make assertions and denials of what is next to it, but never of it, for it is both beyond every assertion, being the perfect and unique cause of all things, and, by virtue of its preeminently simple and absolute nature, free of every limitation, beyond every limitation, it is also beyond every denial. So, there you are. And after you've gotten rid of all of that, all you can do is enter into the silence. And so after you've transcended all of those opposites, every single one of them, without exception. Then you're like, so in this context, there is no speaking, there is no speech, there is nothing to speak about. Well, there is no, it is utterly ineffable. and yet utterly present, as well. And that's considered to be a form of prayer, a form of communion with the divine.
Reminds me a little bit of the heart sutra.
In my commentary on this, I make a comparison to the heart sutra. So I consider Dionysus to be. I consider mystical theology to be the Heart Sutra of the Christian tradition in this sense. Did you notice that Dionysus negated all three aspects of the Trinity? Mm-hmm. It is not fatherhood, it is not sonship, mm-hmm. and it is not spirit. And in the Heart Sutra, it's the Four Noble Truths are negated. There's that same, pattern of going to the very, very important central ideas and saying, but you have to put those aside as well. But notice this, that in that view, there is a kind of a tension between speech and ultimacy. There's still a kind of what I would call a subtle judgment. In the sense that there's the world of speech, and that must be put aside in order to enter into this ultimate domain. I'm putting that out, for consideration.
It doesn't necessarily have to be putting it aside. I like the idea of helping words to find their place in nature, and so that instead of the conceptual mind generating its own reality, the conceptual mind joins the greater reality.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea too. But I don't think Dionysus would. I don't think the author of The Cloud of Unknowing would look at it that way. That's what I'm suggesting.
That was a great piece. I love it.
Yeah.
And yet, isn't there, in Christian mysticism, the terminology of absorption? Absorption.
Yes.
Vanishing
into the divine. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. There is. Although it's interesting, in the 1600s in France and Italy, there was a movement which later became known as Quietism. It was started by a guy by the name of Molinos. I think he was Spanish. He might have been Italian. I'm sorry. But he was very strongly influenced by Dionysus. He quotes mystical theology in particular. And his idea was that you wait quietly for the Lord to speak, or the Lord to be present. And the way you do that is by putting concerns for other things aside. And in other words, you allow for the possibility of grace. Now, he got in a lot of trouble. In fact, he was the Inquisition got a hold of him, and he died under the Inquisition because his method doesn't require the sacraments. His method does not require all his method requires is to wait expectantly upon the Lord, in trust, and eventually that leads to absorption. One of the things that's interesting to me is in the 1700s, the Quaker tradition picked up on this. Manuals of prayer in the Quaker tradition that are based on the works of Molinos and Madame Guyon and that whole quietist group. It's a very interesting intersection, of the tradition. So even though that tradition was sort of completely squashed within Catholicism, it ended up having a home in the Quaker tradition, because the Quakers weren't particularly interested in the sacraments. So that wasn't a barrier, to them. But. Which leads to silence as sacrament. So this book is called Holy Silence by Brent Bill. Brent Bill is a Quaker minister, there's different branches of the Quaker tradition. Some traditions do not have ministers, and some traditions do. And he's from a Quaker tradition that does, and he is one. So, and he, I really enjoyed this book. And the first chapter is called "Silence: The Quaker Sacraments." So I looked up the word sacraments, because, I realized I wasn't really clear about what that meant. And one definition is a rite in which God is uniquely active. Augustine defined it as a visible sign of an invisible reality. Or an outward invisible sign of inward and invisible grace. I find all of those helpful. But Brent Bill's view is that when Quakers enter into silence, it's like, he doesn't say it is a sacrament, but it resembles a sacrament in the sense that it's a rite in which God is uniquely active. It opens up the possibility for God to be present. I kind of like that idea of silence as the sacrament. I find that very enlivening and enriching. I've been attending Quaker meetings for a very short time, so my knowledge is very, very minuscule. When I picked up this book, one of the things which first struck me when I went to a Quaker meeting is that people talk. There's silence, and then people talk, and then there's silence, and then people talk. Someone talks, What struck me about that was, in a Buddhist context, which is my background for decades, say in a Zendo, most of my background is in Korean Zen. If someone stood up from their cushion and began speaking, it would be that would be what we call an interruption. And it would be the job of the person who was in charge, which often in my life would have been me, to go over to the person and ask them to not do that. Or it would depend on the context. I might let it go and then speak to them afterwards, like I say, it would depend. But definitely something should be done about it. That would not be, it would violate the etiquette of a Zendo. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You think? Mm-hmm. That really struck me. From my very first Quaker meeting, I was puzzling over that. Why is it not felt to be an interruption in a Quaker meeting? Both traditions. Let's just confine ourselves to the Zen tradition and the Quaker tradition, because that makes it simpler. The Buddhist tradition is, huge, very complicated history, just like, trying to do Christianity, But if we just, focus on one tradition, Zen, there's this wonderful silence when you go to a Zendo. This is just this rich silence. And one of the things I've always noticed about silence in a Zendo is that there's a kind of a shift from the visual world to the sonic world. In a lot of Zen monasteries, you sit facing the wall. That's not universally true or Zendos, but in a lot of them you do, so that your visual stimulus is shrunk. It's restricted, And the sonic world begins to manifest in many subtle ways that you had missed, before. And I was, I've given a lot of thought to that, and my feeling is that central teachings of Buddhism are much clearer if you use sonic examples to illustrate those teachings than if you use visual examples. So for example, the impermanence of everything. And one of the central teachings of the Buddha is impermanence. Like, that's very clear if you take sonic objects as your focus of contemplation. Sonic objects arise and they fall away. It's not so clear with visual objects. You know, visual objects don't validate that teaching in an obvious way, in the obvious way that sonic objects do. You know, like, so, like, this book looks to me like the same book that I had last week. So it is not advertising the fact that it's impermanent. That shift from the visual realm to the sonic realm, I think that's a fundamental aspect of the practice of Zazen or Zen meditation. There's kind of a constant teaching that one enters into by doing that. So why would somebody standing up and speaking, let's say they're speaking about some insight they've had, maybe they're quoting Dogen or something. So why would that be an interruption? And this is tentative. I'm still giving this a lot of thought, and any feedback you have I'd be interested in hearing. But tentatively, in a Zen context, and even in a broader Buddhist context, you're trying to keep your mind in a particular confirmation. Instructions for meditation will be to hold your mind in such a way, and when you notice that your mind has drifted from that particular confirmation, then you pull back. So if somebody starts speaking, it interrupts that concentration. So to pick a really gross parallel, if I'm working on my taxes and I have all my, stuff there, and I'm concentrating on that, and somebody comes in the room and starts talking, even if it's really interesting, my tendency will be to say, not now. Not now. Later. And the response to someone talking within a Zendo, I think it would feel similarly. Not now. This is not the time. Sarah Maitland, when she began exploring silence, she discovered that within, very close to her home, there was a Zendo called Throstle Hole, which has been in England for quite a while. I can't remember, maybe 40 or 50 years, something like that. And also a friend's meeting house was also very, very close to her. So she began going back and forth. And as I was, I was thinking about this, serendipitously, a friend gave me this book, which he got from England, and here's this chapter about, contrasting Zen and Quaker, Zen and Quaker silence. So, fascinating. Here's what she, a little bit of what she has to say. She says, Zen silence is an oppositional silence. You are silent in order to escape from the self and the dualisms of the world, to protest against the veils of illusion and transcend them. I think that's a little bit of an overreach, but I understand what she's saying in the sense that not now is an opposition. There's certain things are not, certain sounds are not part of the environment, and we don't want them there. Let's see. Then she found this Quaker meeting, and she said, at first sight, the externals could not have been more different from Throstle Hole, the Zendo she attended. The meeting I attended in Durham took place in a slightly grotty community hall that lacked both the beauty and the glamour of the dojo, and we sat in a dowdy circle on stacking chairs. But in another sense, Quaker meeting is not unlike Zazen. Zazen is the name for Zen meditation. Although Quakers come into silence for the silent meeting, while the Zen monks bring their existing silence into meditation, the Quakers, or the Religious Society of France, as they are more properly called, are probably most famous in Britain for their commitment to pacifism and for the radical lead they have given since the 17th century in various forms of social justice, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, prison reform, and mental health care. But at the heart of Quaker life is the meeting for worship, and this is primarily silent, or rather a meeting in which any words emerge from silence. So a modern Quaker, Pierre Lacour, describes the silence in the meeting thus. In silence, which is active, the inner light begins to glow, a tiny spark. Where the flame to be kindled and to grow, subtle argument and clamor of our emotions must be stilled. It is by an attention full of love that we enable the inner light to blaze and illuminate our dwelling and to make our whole being a source from which this light may shine out. Words must be purified in a redemptive silence if they are to bear the message of peace. The right to speak is a call to the duty of listening. Speech has no meaning unless there are attentive minds and silent hearts. Silence is the welcoming acceptance of the other. The word born of silence must be received in silence. So, you know, to me it was a huge shift going to a Quaker meeting, because it was like, oh, words are not necessarily opposed to silence. You know, like, words can become part of the silence. The way I describe this to myself is that in a Quaker meeting, words and silence are porous. You know, like to each other. You know, there isn't a wall between them. They're porous to each other, and I find a great beauty in that. You know, like that words can participate in this silent world. So when I say in this silent world, I mean that words can be placed in such a way that they're like the sound of the wind, or the quacking of the ducks, like something like that. You know, like that they have that same resonance and sometimes beauty and meaning. And you've been wanting to say something for a while. I'm sorry to keep you waiting.
No, your time is perfect.
Oh, good.
Sometimes there is a sense in Quaker meeting of the silence wanting something. The silence wanting something to be said, or calling something to be said. And I remember in one meeting, a woman, you could kind of feel a tension in her. And then she stood and she spoke, and it was just this great eloquence, and coming from this incredible place, and then afterwards the tension was gone, and it was this incredible peace, and so there is a sense that the silence is alive and it's asking for things sometimes, and we're there kind of to serve it, and it's.
That's the presence we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That's the silence, it's presence. So I have two stories about that. I think it's in the Brent Bill book. You might have read it in another book. People by now know that I inhale books. So. this one man reported the following story. he had studied in France abroad, and he was very fluent in French. But since returning to the United States, he had very little opportunity to use it. But he was in a meeting, and he had this leading to stand up and speak in French. And he, you know, like in, like he resisted, you know, like for. But then he felt that it was genuine, you know, like, and he did. And then he sat down, and it turned out one of the guests was from France, you know, like, you know, like, and so it was perfect. Like, and then there's a story I've heard from several people where somebody stood up in a meeting and spoke, and he was next to a window that was open onto a street, you know, like, and then when the meeting was over, somebody came in and said that they'd been walking by the window, and that was exactly what they needed to hear. that kind of thing, you know, like, so there, that's silence's presence, but you have to be in a context which holds that, you know, like, which will allow for that possibility, you know, like, so that those kinds of things can manifest.
As somebody who came to Buddhism from Quakerism, one of the things I found valuable in the Quaker way of practice is that it strongly de-emphasized a leader and emphasized that wisdom and insight was dispersed throughout the whole community. So as you sat in silence, something might emerge from anyone present, which I think was really useful. And then the other aspect was it was much harder to get caught up in your own little track of, you know, selfie thoughts, mm-hmm. because others would speak and often pull you out of your, you know, your delusion of self, mm-hmm. and raise a whole other new issue you hadn't been on.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm drawn to the sacrament of silence, mm-hmm. in the sense of my teacher has always said the Zendo needs to hold that silence in a sense of a sacrament.
Oh, nice.
And even in the sense of energetically building the chi,
mm-hmm.
of the participants, that it actually can still reside. And if you're ever, I have been in retreats when someone through perhaps having an emotional breakdown, you know, breaks that sacrament, and mm-hmm. it's very potent. You can feel it. Mm-hmm. You can feel the energy dissipate. And I was drawn to the idea that, you know, the reason I think the friends were called Quakers is because there was a time when the silence would build in people until they literally shook.
Mm-hmm.
They quaked. That's what they were. Why they were called Quakers.
That's my understanding as well. On YouTube, there's some Quaker stuff on YouTube. And there's one which interviews a series of... This is in Britain, you know, of modern Quakers, and about rising and speaking. And they all talk about, you know, like, that sense of being compelled to, you know, like the, you know, like there's kind of a fluttering in the heart or something, mm-hmm. like that, and sometimes not even knowing what it is they're going to say, or, you know, that it just sort of emerges. You know, like,
but this isn't the physical. I mean, my...
No, they I know. In the early centuries, they literally, you know...
Wasn't it the build... I mean, yeah. You experience it in a 7-day retreat of silence and mm-hmm. meditating where the chi is built up, right. So tremendously the whole body can vibrate.
Right.
Vibrating might be more than...
I want to make one comment about the chi and the energy you're talking about. I have a hypothesis that when a group meditates together, particularly when they meditate in silence, that heartbeat, brain waves, breathing become synchronized, and that's the more the group does it together, you know, over the years, the more that that's true, you know, like, and I think that's part of the qualitative difference between meditating in a group and meditating alone. Mm. I mean, meditating alone has its virtues, but I know from many years of experience that silent contemplation or meditation in a group, there is a definite qualitative difference. And I've really come to think that there is a synchronization and a connection of rhythm, chi flowing, you know, through the community. That's an actual. I think if you had the proper organ of perception, you probably could see it. You know, like,
and do you think that happens in a Quaker meeting?
Yes, I do. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Well, then I'm going to close.
Okay. I always found this confusing for myself. You know, there's a fork in the road. There's a Buddha on each road. And one Buddha says, you're going to follow me. You're going to struggle against the roof chatter in your head, your manifestations, and eventually you will produce a new you. And when I go to the other Buddha on the other path, he says, oh, don't struggle. Don't do anything. Just watch yourself, and eventually you will produce a new you. Which one do you think is...
Which one? Actually,
who is the real
door number one? I think that at different times in life, either one may be appropriate. You know, like there have been times in my life where I've had to place myself under the strict tutelage of a fairly strong traditional East Asian master who said, "Be silent," because, you know, that's the way I was, you know, like, at that time. And then there are other times where I had to disintegrate that external form. And I needed to learn to have the confidence in my own intuition, in my own understanding. You know, like, so I don't think it's an either or.
Okay, so you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
I would say that maybe in between both options is the conception of philosophy. Maybe in between both options is the conception of philosophy.
Oh, okay. That's a nice place for philosophy. Thank you. Philosophy does have a place in the world. Good.
And that's only two options.
Right. Yeah. Right. And there's more than two options. Thank you. Thank you.
I was thinking, one of the few really useful things that Kim Wilber's come out with lately.
All right.
In the last few years, he's been talking about God in the first, second, and third person. That, you know, we can relate to the divine as an object, as an it. We can relate to it as something within us, or we can relate to it as a transcendent other. Mm-hmm. And the quality, you know, whichever of those you sort of presuppose has a lot to do with the quality of how you approach something like silence. You know, if you're looking for some rarefied state within yourself, that's very different from, you know, sitting in silence in relation to God or a transcendent other.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that's a great segue to what I was just going to talk about, and that is silence is awe. You know, like, and silence is beauty. So more and more...
I thought it was brutal. The long silence was 12 days, and I was going to...
And then there's that perspective. More and more is... in my journey, I am awestruck by the immensity of the mystery, and my response to that is to be be dumbstruck like, by the immensity and the sense of the miraculous that, oh my God, I'm here in this world, you know, like, and it's just really, you know, like, how did that happen? You know, like, and if I try and figure out how it happened, I cannot do it. It's completely, you know, it's completely beyond my comprehension. And that entering into completely beyond my comprehension is my sense of awe and, you know, letting go of any feeling that I can get a handle around this or figure it out or describe it adequately. There's in the book of Habakkuk, he says, "But the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him." So that's kind of where I am in my journey through silence at this time. You know.
What about the silence as beauty that you mentioned? That also part of the awe?
It's part of the awe. You know, it's like the Psalms often talk about the beauty of the world, you know, the beauty and the holiness of existence, you know, like, and, I mean, how did that happen? like, how did that sunset happen? You know, like, how did that, you know, like, it, so, those are my observations on silence. I hope they have been of some assistance, and, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. And if you want to hang out and we can yammer more about silence, there are books on silence over there. And you can peruse them. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. I just want to point out that we have a donation bowl over there on the counter, and we share the proceeds of that bowl with the speaker to assist his work in promoting silence, in this case, and also to create and maintain the space in which this silence and these words can coexist fruitfully. So thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you.